Okay, morning everyone.
Morning.
Back to week five. Let's hope all those on Zoom, we hope to keep you there the whole time this week. With the help of Hashem and no internet problems. So just to review a little bit from last week, first of all. So we talked last week about the extension of ego, which is anger. Anger is another expression of arrogance. Which, like arrogance, we said, is one of these things that can't really be transformed or rechanneled. It needs to be eradicated or removed. At least that's the aspiration. And we talked about lots of different quotes from King Solomon, and the bottom line of all of it was that a few things. Number one, no one is really immune. It can happen to everyone, and it does happen to everyone. It's bad for us. Rage and losing our temper is bad for us, spiritually and physically. It's extremely hard to overcome, but it's very great to overcome. It's like we learn from the Pirkei Avot, Ezehu Gibor, who's a strong person who overcomes his impulse and is able to control himself or herself, and it's considered stronger and more powerful than conquering a city. And then we also quoted from Mishlei, from the King Solomon's Proverbs, that in terms of strategy, we talked about, first of all, the idea of calm language, ma'anerach, calm language, getting used to the concept of talking in a calm, measured way. Divrei chachamim, the words of the wise, are always heard calmly, as the Talmud says. That's always an antidote to inflaming the situation and getting angry. And we ended off with this concept that the main thing is to acknowledge, in other words, the worst thing is that when we get angry, is not to acknowledge that we got angry and to think that it was justified or coming to the other person and so on and so forth, whereas if we at least know where it's coming from, even though we all are not perfect and we do lose it sometimes, but then at least we know that we can work on it and we can keep improving and so on. So before we get today, just I told some of you, but just an announcement for those who just come onto Zoom. So the next 2 weeks I'm going to be away. I'm traveling Be'ezrat Hashem to visit my mother in South Africa. So there won't be a shiur the next two Thursdays. However, there will be one after that on the 2nd of December, which also coincides with Hanukkah, and we'll do some lessons and personal growth ideas from the Hanukkah candles and so on. So that's that, and that'll be the last lesson of the term. So there is one more to go, which will be on the 2nd of December. Okay. Today, I want to bring two ideas from the wisdom of King Solomon, from the verses of Proverbs. One is touched on in Mishlei. It's a negative thing, but we can explore it and also explore the antidote to it. So the first part of it is the idea of atzlut, which is laziness. Laziness, right, people? So what's the definition of laziness? What would you say? How do you define laziness?
Not being motivated.
Yeah, I guess. So the... I looked up a dictionary definition, not in King Solomon's work, just a modern dictionary. And it says, averse or disinclined to work, activity, or exertion. Okay? So it's when people just... It's right. It's got a lot to do with not being motivated, not being driven, not being... not wanting to do things, even though we know those things need to be done or they might be important and they need to get done for whatever reason. We're just too lazy. We just therefore end up procrastinating, wasting time, being idle, and so on and so forth. As we see, King Solomon already said that laziness is not a good thing at all. And the way he puts it in a very strange way. And he puts it in context, actually, not only being negative or non-productive for the person who themselves are lazy, but not being good for a person who asks a lazy person to do something for them, right? So the sender of a lazy person, that's what he puts it. So he writes like this, a very strange, almost a cryptic verse. He says, like vinegar to the teeth. Apparently, vinegar is bad for your teeth.
Acid.
Sorry?
Acid.
Acid.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Just didn't have, he didn't have Coke in those times.
No, but I'm saying that's what it's like.
You're right, right.
Acid.
If you swish it around, I guess, yeah. So he says, like vinegar to the teeth and like smoke to the eyes, which is also not good. So is a lazy person, a sluggard, as it's translated here, to those who send him. So you send someone to do something that is a lazy person, it backfires on you, it becomes like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes. Now, what does that mean? So, simply put, right, it's just like vinegar irritates a person's teeth and smoke irritates the eyes. So a lazy person really harms someone that depends on them, right? So if you depend on a lazy person and don't get it done, and then things don't get done, and there's a snowball effect, and so on and so forth. So it's irritating. The failure of the lazy person causes the irritation and the harm to the person that sent the lazy person, right?
Antagonist.
Yeah, well, it becomes an antagonist, yeah. Starts with laziness, but it antagonizes. Now, the some of the commentary things, the Vilna Gaon points out, so why? What's the imagery of vinegar and smoke? Well, why does King Solomon put it that way? So he explains a very beautiful idea. He says like this, that if a person drinks vinegar, there's two problems that happen. One is that it's bad for the appetite, apparently. It loses the appetite. And second of all, it becomes hard to eat because it irritates the teeth. Right? Similarly, he says a person who tries to produce light, fire, right, out of damp wood. He says not only would there be no light because it wouldn't work, what it would do is it would irritate even further because it creates a lot of smoke and then it becomes, so there's a double damage, right? So he says the same thing. That's why King Solomon in his wisdom gives that imagery of vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes. Because when you depend on someone, right, and you send someone to do a mission who's lazy, two things happen. First thing happened is he doesn't get the job done, which is not good. It's not good for the person, not good for the messenger. It's not good for a person not to be fulfilled, not to accomplish, and not to get things done. And it's also very agitating and irritating for the person in that sense. So there's a double problem, which is why King Solomon uses this imagery of smoke to the eyes or vinegar to the teeth, right? So that's just a very simple interpretation of this verse. But the question remains, why did King Solomon choose to talk about the sender? Why doesn't he just talk about the evil of being lazy for ourselves? What's it got to do with the person who sent the lazy person, right? Why is that important? So Rabbeinu Yonah, a great early sage, talking, I think, 12th, 13th century, who commentates on Mishlei, on Proverbs, he says the following. He says, because actually this pasuk, this verse, not only talking about two people, one sending another, this verse is also talking about us as being messengers of Hashem, messengers of God, right? And we know that God put us on this earth to accomplish. He put us with a mission to live by certain values, to make the world a better place, to have a connection to Him, right? Through various different things that we do and we're supposed to do and so on and so forth. And He gave us a job. And that job often doesn't get done because, for many reasons, but one of the reasons that the job often doesn't get done is because of laziness. We're not motivated, we're not driven, we don't have the spark, right? So King Solomon writes, that's why he talks about a sender. He says what happens is then, number one, it's damaging to us if we don't accomplish, if we don't become a better person, if we don't accomplish the mission for which we were put in this earth for. And second of all, it irritates the one who sent us, which is Hashem. He gave us life. He gives us life each day. He allows us to wake up and He asks us to live a certain way and to do things that will make us and the world a better place. So obviously it's irritating to Him that we don't get it done. So that's the deeper relationship between the sender and the lazy person, which explains why King Solomon would do that, because he's trying to motivate people to do the right thing. Why he uses the imagery of the sender and the person who's being sent who is lazy. Right? Now, what's interesting is the following. That although there are things that are worse than laziness. Laziness is not the most evil thing a person could be, right? However, we find with laziness, someone who's lazy and procrastinates and that laziness just leads to emptiness, there's something actually that's worse than other things about laziness. Because what laziness is, right, it's actually more an absence of an emotion than a negative emotion. Right, you follow what I'm saying? I'm just apathetic. I just don't care. Right? I don't have a problem with it. Right? So even on a very basic level, if you wanna argue with someone, right? A person who's indifferent, it's very hard to argue with them. So it's more frustrating. Right? A person disagrees with you, at least he's got a view. So now we can now have someone to work with, right? With ourselves, it's the same thing. So that's why we know that laziness, and we'll talk about the Hebrew word in a second, laziness often is very much connected with sadness or depression.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Right.
It's more like this person's depressed.
Right, so that doesn't necessarily mean clinical depression, because that's... Because laziness, when you say the word laziness, the connotation that is that a person who's lazy can do something about it, right? So it's what
it's not if they're depressed.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So it's what I call depression with a small d, right? There's depression with a small d and depression with a big d. It's always an important distinction to make. Clinical depression is a pathology. It's not an outcome of laziness. It has symptoms of laziness, but it's not laziness. It's actually it's a sickness, right? For which not always the person is in control and can do anything about it, as we know in mental health area. I mean, they can do things to help it, but they haven't got it's not a choice. Like, people who are really depressed, is that's the way they are. They've got to get intervention, right? With the intervention comes a willingness to get better, and of course to do things as well, but that normally a person cannot fix on their own. They need intervention, they need professionals, they need therapy, whatever they need, right? When I talk about sadness or depression, I'm not talking about what I call depression with a small d, which is something we all experience once in a while. We just, you know, we're just not driven and we're lethargic and we're just not interested. We can get out of it. We're not sick. We can snap out of it if you want to, if you make the choice to. And we can do something about it, which we'll talk about soon. But it certainly comes with it. And we know about atzvut, which is being sad or being unhappy, that it actually is not an emotion. It's the absence of an emotion, which is worse. Right? Now, fascinating enough, we know that in Hebrew, we've said this many times, but we know in Hebrew, the Hebrew language, because of its design, divine design, and because of its holiness, words connect, and they connect by having similar letters, right? Which means that's because when letters, each letter in Hebrew language represents a spiritual energy, and when things share spiritual letters, similar letters, it means they have a connection, and so on. So what's interesting is that the word for sadness in Hebrew, or depression with a small d, is atzvut. Atzvut means to be sad.
Sorry, what's it?
Atzvut, ayin salik vet vavtov. Atzvut. The word for laziness is atzlut. Very, very similar letters, right? It's just one letter different. Yep. So it has a very, very strong connection. And that's why it's in a way worse. Because it's harder to fix in a way. Because there's nothing really there to channel. It's empty. In other words, it's an emptiness. It's a sadness. It's a lack of emotion, rather than a negative emotion, which can be worked with at least, right? So just to extrapolate that a little bit, so there's a famous piece in the book of Tanya, which we've mentioned before, where it talks about the godly soul and the animal soul often breeding animalistic type of impulses or reactions or emotions, and he says that we can divide it into four groups, because just like physically, we know the concept that the world is divided into four different elements or four different foundations, which is the foundation of fire, right? Fire, water, wind, and earth, dust, right? Esh, Mayim, Ruach, and Afar, as we call it, right? And many things work that way, many things are divided that way. So too, spiritually, he says the animal soul is made up of these four things. And those four, each one of these four things breed another sort of animalistic emotion or impulsive emotion. So he says, Aish, fire, is the cause of, the fire part of our animal soul is the cause of anger and arrogance. Note, he puts anger and arrogance together, which fits into what we explained last week, right? Why is that fire? Because it's passionate, it's fiery, it's fire always goes upwards, similar to in the negative way, similar to anger and arrogance, which is a superiority sort of feeling and so on and so forth, right? Water, we know in Kabbalah it always says, water is the source of lust, of desires and indulgence. The reason for that is because water is the source of growth of all delicacies, right? That's why water is always associated with, it also draws, it's drawn towards something. So water is the idea of indulging in things that are just tempting, right? Overindulging in a negative way. Ruach, wind, because wind has no substance, it's like not tangible really. So that represents the concept of just emptiness, scoffing, that kind of, it's different to arrogance. Arrogance is more when you think you actually have something to be arrogant about. The the hoilus and the sonus, and he calls his sporus, which is like a sort of a very empty sort of arrogance, or just scoffing at everything, a cynic, being cynical, that kind of thing. That comes from the idea of wind. And then he says the earth part of who we are, afar, that's a source of atzlut and atzvut, laziness and sadness. Again, see the connection, he connects the two. The concept of laziness, being empty, not being motivated, not being drawn to do something. Now the problem is that the first three are very bad. In fact, we know, we said last week, kas and gaiva, anger and rage, need to be eradicated actually, right? But the good thing about a person who's angry or even arrogant, there's not a lot of good in that, but the good thing at least is that the person's alive, right? The person that's alive has some hope. You can work with it. You can say you need to channel. Okay, that's not channeling. So anger and angers don't get channeled, they get eradicated. But at least you're working, it could be replaced at least with something else, right? Lust the same way, a desire, indulgence. It means the power. Certain people are very needy, they're very indulgent people, right? But you can channel indulgence to good things. You can indulge in that which is good, right? A person can indulge in learning, indulge in chesed, in doing kindness. You can indulge in things which you can learn to enjoy, which are good things. So it's a channeling of a negative thing, right? Even cynicism or again, at least the person's alive. They're doing something. They're hard to take. It's very hard to take a cynical person, but they're alive. They're there. When it comes to afar and atzlut and atzvut, which is laziness and sadness, that comes from the earth part of who we are, which is heavy. It's weighing us down. It's empty, and it breeds to sadness and a lack of motivation, a lack of being driven, a lack of simcha, lack of joy, which we know is a terrible thing, right? I think we've mentioned this before. There's a Hasidic saying that in the Torah, there's no aveira, there's no transgression to be sad. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah, they shall not be sad, right? But it says it can draw you down and damage you worse than any transgression could. That's what it said. You know, they used to say that. Atzvus is not an aveira, but it can damage you worse than any aveira, right? Because that's what it is. It's a source of all evil. Once you're not motivated, once you're driven, once you're empty, emptiness is a source. Emptiness attracts all bad things, right? And that concept of atzvah, that concept of sadness, goes together with a person who's lazy and empty. I don't know when the last time was you saw a lazy person that was happy, right? Because they're not. You know why? Because no one wants to be lazy. That's the truth. No one feels good for being lazy. I'm not talking about taking a day off and saying I'm going to be lazy, having a lazy day. That's okay, right? Everyone needs a rest sometimes. But a person is just generally like just unfulfilled, empty, not doing much. They might not be motivated to get things done or to go and do things done, but normally they're not happy people because there's an emptiness there. There's a real emptiness and we know that people need to fulfill. Going back to the famous Viktor Frankl, people need to live a life of meaning. Living a life of meaning takes a bit of work. It takes drive, it takes motivation, it takes enthusiasm, it takes passion, right? So therefore, that concept of laziness and atzvut always go together. A lazy person is normally naturally sad, not sad, but like not happy, unfulfilled, empty. And of course, lack of, and sadness breeds the laziness as well. So the two feed off each other and they become problematic, right? Now, everything has a positive. So I'll just tell you one thing before we go further. We need to try and get rid of laziness, but it has a positive to turn it around. And the positive is just a story that I'll just share with you. I'm sure I've shared this with you before, but in 1977, on Simchat Torah, Shmini Atzeret actually, during the Hakafot, during the dancing, the Lubavitcher Rebbe had a heart attack, a very famous thing, right? Quite a severe heart attack, actually. At the time, he refused to go to hospital, and they turned his room into an ICU unit. For all the machinery, all the thing, right? He didn't want to go, he thought it would be worse. The doctors later agreed with him that it was the right decision, because he would have been very distressed by being away from his Hasidim. The Hasidim would have been distressed, knowing that the Hasidim were distressed would have made him more distressed, and would actually have been physically bad for him. Anyway, but they brought everything they needed there, so eventually they got doctors who would agree. They worked with him, and he had many, many conversations with doctors. Interesting enough, on a side note, actually, I just heard recently an interview by Dr. Ira Weiss, who was the Rebbe's doctor at the time. He came from Chicago on Yom Tov, and he was the a very young but very up-and-coming, prominent cardiologist. And he became very close with the Rebbe afterwards. He had tremendous discussions with him. And I just saw him tell a story that the Rebbe suggested. The Rebbe was very well-read and very smart and very well-versed in medical stuff, other stuff, other than, strictly speaking, Torah learning. And the Rebbe asked him if, you know, he asked him to describe the heart attack, and they described certain parts of the tissue, certain tissue of the heart that became damaged. So the Rebbe asked, could it be regenerated? So he said, well, not at the moment. We don't have any technology for that. So the Rebbe said, what about stem cell research? And at the time, even he didn't know about it. So he didn't know what the Rebbe was talking about. It had just come out, and the Rebbe had already read about it. It was very interesting. He says he was blown away by the heart. Anyway, so that was just a side thing. But one of the things needed to be done is always a person who's in the hospital, the doctor needed to take a blood test. Or number of blood tests, whatever. So the Rebbe asked them to describe how it actually works. Very interested in how, you know, normally we just go and take a blood test. We don't care how it works. It works, right? But he wanted to know, he wanted to understand how it works. The doctor explained that you make a thing in the vein and you create a vacuum, and it's the vacuum in the syringe that attracts the blood, right? So the Rebbe said, you know, the Baal Shem Tov said everything you have to learn a lesson from. So he said that that's a big lesson in life. And he went on to tell a doctor a recent story that had happened. He said someone had written to him. Someone had written to the Rebbe asking for advice because the person was complaining that he feels very empty, very down and very lethargic and like he doesn't know how to get out of it, right? That's, I guess it wasn't clinical depression, but it was like that kind of emptiness. And the Rebbe told him that he has an opportunity. Why? Because the Rebbe says that when you grow, right, when a person grows, so we grow one step after another. So we grow, we take one step forward. So it's what we call incremental growth, right? And normally when we grow, so when one thing evolves into another, it's still connected to the previous thing in a way. But he said when you create a vacuum in your life, when there's like an emptiness, you need to turn around your thinking. You need to look at the emptiness as an opportunity. As an opportunity to merge in something completely different. Right, similar to the idea which you mentioned many times about when you plant a seed, the seed disappears, it disintegrates before the tree actually emerges. Because real growth means to produce something completely new, right? And to do something completely new, you have to let go of the previous thing first. So in a way, that's the opportunity of laziness, he says, that you feel like a vacuum in your life, you feel like an emptiness, now's your chance to like close one book and open up something completely different, right? And he said, that's the idea, same thing as a blood test, that blood is vitality, it's life. But how do you attract new life? You have to create an emptiness first. That's an empty thing. You create like a vacuum and that attracts the thing. Anyway. However, it's hard to do that. And of course, while we have it, it's a negative thing and it's a very destructive thing. So how do we fight it? Other than also the perspective of this idea of a new, an opportunity for newness. So we know that when we fight anything that's negative, we've talked about this before, any negative emotion or lack of emotion for that matter, it's always very hard to change the emotion itself. The emotions are who we are, as we've discussed. So we work on two fronts. We work on what's lower than the emotion and what's higher than the emotion. So we work on behavior. We force ourselves into certain behaviors. And then we also attack the head. So we try and change our thinking, right? Very much connected with this week's parsha, by the way. Because our thinking often directs and guides how we feel, right? As we know, it's the most powerful tool that we have as human beings. This week's parasha, Yaakov, he's traveling, he's running away from his brother Esav, who wanted to kill him, and he's traveling to Haran, where his uncle is, and that's where he finds his wives, Rachel and Leah, and so on. When he's on the way, he stops off at the Temple Mount. And the Temple Mount, he lies down. Well, what later became the Temple Mount, right? He lies down and he prays there, but he also lies down. And when he lays down, the Torah says he takes 12 stones, and he puts it around his head, right? Why does he do that? So Rashi says, and the Talmud tells us, he wanted to create a protection for wild animals and the beasts of the jungle, right? Which of course is bizarre, because anyone knows that you don't have to understand animals to know that if you go to sleep at night and you want to protect yourself from wild animals, putting a little fence around your head is not going to help. Right, the lion is quite capable of attacking your heart. He doesn't have to go for your head if you can't get to it, right? So the commentaries explain, of course, this wasn't a physical thing. It was much more of a spiritual thing. Because Yaakov was on the way to Haran. He was on the way to a place of immorality, a place of distorted thinking, a place of bad values, which it was. He went to a place that was a very, very spiritually damaging area. And he knew he needs to protect himself, and he prayed to God to be protected. He wanted to be able to be there, and he ended up being there for 20 years, and he survived. He was righteous, and he was spiritual, and he was not influenced by the environment. But he knew that the thing to protect, first and foremost, is his thinking. So when we change our thinking, that's when everything goes from there, right? So though the goal here is really changing how we feel and how we respond when we talk about laziness or anger, but it starts from the head. But it also, conversely, also starts from the way we act. So those two things can help to create better responses. So in terms of a practical thing, we know that one of the greatest methods, of course, when a person is feeling empty, it often comes from this feeling of being overwhelmed. Like just so much to do, so we just don't do any of it, right? Often when a person is not naturally a lazy person, but we sort of feel just lazy for a day, very often it has to do with, we know there's so much to do, we just don't know where to start, so we just don't do it, right? Hoping somehow, in the distorted way that we think, that it'll just happen or go away or that kind of thing, right? So obviously the practical strategy behind that, we know, is to break it down, right? Because success breeds success, and behavior, sense of accomplishment always, it creates drive and creates motivation. So we create a game within ourselves, right? We decide, okay, we're not going to do the whole thing. We're not going to finish all 20 tasks on our list. We're just going to do one, or we can do half of one, right? And to get something done. And normally when we do it like that, so we do something one, and we celebrate the success, and that leads to a bit more motivation, and the motivation grows, and then we hopefully work on laziness that way. So it's about what they call in modern day language, I think Stephen Covey language, they call it the salami method. In other words, cutting it up into thin slices and taking each slice one slice at a time, right? One day at a time, one moment at a time, one experience at a time. Very much connected, of course, with mindful living, where you just focus on the now, make the now work, make the now fulfilled, and then worry about the next moment when you get there. Okay, so that's a thing. However, of course, we need to work on our mind. We have to work on the perspective that we have as well. Which really means what we have to do is we have to find, in our thinking at least, and it is in our thinking, which I'll explain to you why it is, we have to find the antidote to laziness, which is joy, simcha. Right? Now, because, as we said, Atzlut and Atzvut are connected, right? Laziness and sadness are connected. So when we build up the feeling of joy, the feeling of simcha, the feeling of happiness, that doesn't go together with laziness. So that creates a drive, that creates a life force. It breaks boundaries. We know that Talmud tells us simcha poretz geder, joy breaks boundaries. In Hebrew, the word sameach, again using Hebrew letters, is very much connected to the word tsameach, which is growth. Because when we feel happy, when we feel joyous, we're ready to push. Right? Now, what does that mean to be happy? And how does it create the antidote to laziness, right? What does it mean? We should dance, we should sing. What does it mean? So, of course, we know it doesn't work like that. We know that happiness is very much a state of our mind. Right? Of course, there's part of happiness is to find moments of happiness, what I mean more, moments of celebration. That's true. And celebration feeds into happiness. But happiness is not celebration. It's two different things. You know what I'm making sense?
Isn't that confusing that one's pleasure and one's happiness? Externally.
Yeah. We'll talk about that in a minute. But celebration could also be internal. Celebration is not a bad thing. We have good moments of celebration. So we celebrate milestones, we celebrate weddings, we celebrate a Brit, we celebrate accomplishments, right? We celebrate Purim, we celebrate Yontif, we do lots of, right? And it's those times where we're not just happy, but we actually celebrate. It's like there's a mitzvah and a Yontif to drink wine and to eat meat or whatever, to be happy in the celebration context, right? Which supports the ongoing joy, but joy is not celebration. Joy is a mindset, and it's a mindset which is constant. And because it's a mindset that is constant, it helps fight laziness for reasons that we're going to see in a moment. In a nutshell, we know, as we've talked about many, many times, happiness is a state of mind coming from inside out. It's a feeling of meaning, purpose. That's what it is. It's a contentment. It's a inner fulfillment that comes from a focus and a sense of purpose. And a sense of being able to find purpose in everything that we do. Right? So let's look how King Solomon says. King Solomon says the following. First, a couple of different verses. He says, Lev Sameach, a glad heart, a happy heart. Yetiv Panim will cheer the face. But Uva Atzvatle, but a despondent heart, Ruach Necha'a causes a broken spirit. Right? So, what does it mean, sadness of the heart, right? So the commentaries explain like this, and it goes, they explain in a particular context, but it goes to the heart of what we've always explained, the difference between joy or happiness and pleasure, right? Where pleasure is an outside in thing, it's external, nothing wrong with having a bit of pleasure, but the pursuit of pleasure or living our life around pleasure is taking something from the outside and enjoying it. We know that it's normally in the moment, it's transient, it's self-centered, and it breeds a want for more, right? Like the famous Talmud that he who has 100 wants 200, he who has 200 wants 400, and so on and so forth. It never stops, unsatiable, right? Why? Because when a person confuses pleasure with happiness, the pleasure doesn't last. Pleasure, by definition, is transient. It only lasts while you're having pleasure. Mm-hmm. And therefore, because it only lasts while you're having pleasure, then when that's over, then the gaping hole and need for pleasure resurfaces and reemerges, and then you want more. So it's never satisfied, right? Whereas simcha, joy, comes from inside out, as we've explained many times, and therefore it's a sense of finding purpose and inner fulfillment in everything that we do. That purpose breeds more happiness, not less happiness, not like pleasure. Because we then driven to find deeper purpose and more purpose. How does it come? So interestingly enough, the commentaries on this particular verse where King Solomon talks about a happy heart versus a sad heart, which a sad heart causes a broken spirit, whereas a happy heart cheers up a person, they talk about this person, this concept which is talked about in Pirkei Avot, which Ezehu Ashir, who is a truly wealthy person, Hasameach Bechelko, he who is happy with what he or she has. Right? Now, of course, we want every person to have everything in abundance and everything that they need to be as comfortable as possible. Right? We pray for that, and we ask Hashem to grant everyone sustenance, upranasat, so on and so on and so forth. But it all depends how we use it. We know that there are plenty of people who have a lot, but they're not happy. Because it doesn't help how much you have. And a lot of people have far less, aren't very happy, right? Because happiness doesn't depend. There's research studies, I know I've heard from Dr. Pelkowitz many times. There are research studies out today that define happiness and clearly say that following the basic needs of a person, once a person has basically what they need to live, food, shelter, and so on, right? In a way that they're not overly anxious or worried, once they have that, then after that, it makes no difference how much a person has in terms of happiness. Right? It actually doesn't work. It doesn't have any correlation. Now, the study works after people are comfortable because obviously, not that a person who has less than they need can't be happy, because we know plenty of stories of people that were happy, even that nothing, but it definitely is much harder because, as the Talmud says, aniyut, like poverty, distracts the human being. And therefore, because it distracts, it makes it harder to achieve happiness, not impossible, but harder. Right, but once a person has what they need and they have to remove that distraction, the rest has to do with them, with their perspective, their mind, their heart, what they're thinking in their mind and their heart, and nothing to do with how much more they have. Right. And that's why King Solomon says that a happy heart cheers up the face, whereas a broken heart doesn't, a sad heart doesn't, because it has to do with having that feeling inside out, having that inner feeling of purpose, meaning, depth, and so on. Which of course ties into the next verse that he talks about joy. And he says like this. It's a cryptic verse because it almost sounds like it means something else. But he says like that. He says, Kol yemei ani ra'im. All the days of a poverty-stricken person are wretched, are broken, right? But v'tov leiv, a good-hearted person, mishteh tamid, has a perpetual party, a Perpetual feast.
Perpetual
feast. Feast. Party.
Oh, right.
Mishteh means like a party,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So what was that supposed to mean, right? So that's what it means. A person who's got a good heart, meaning, when he talks about a poverty-stricken person, it doesn't mean a person who has no money. It means a person who's not happy with what they have. A person who has not happy with what they have doesn't have anything. Right? And there are people who have everything and have nothing because they're not happy with what they have. That's what he's talking about. Kol yamei ani, all the days of a poverty-stricken person, the ra'im are evil, are bad. Because the person is never happy. Right? But v'tov lev, a person has a good heart. What is that good heart? So the commentary explained, the good heart means it's a person whose heart is coming from the inside, who lives by their heart, who doesn't live from the externalities, who lives from within their soul, lives from within their purpose, finds and understands that there's an ability to find purpose in everything because God wouldn't give us the moment unless that moment wasn't a moment where we could make work. We wouldn't have the day if we couldn't make the day work. God wouldn't give us that day. Now, obviously, we pray never to be tested, and sometimes the day looks a lot more challenging than otherwise, but a true happy person knows that you can, doesn't matter what the day it is, our values never change, our soul never changes. So even if it's a challenging day, we can find purpose in that day. We can find joy in that day. That kind of a person is tov lev, is a good heart, which means they're working from within, they're working from the foundation of their neshama, of their heart, of their soul. Therefore, the whole life becomes a mishteh, because every day is another opportunity, no matter what the day is. Every day is an opportunity. If a person lives that way, a person lives by way of purpose, which brings joy, real joy, he or she is happy with what they have, what really matters to them more is the purpose of life, living from within. Therefore, that person becomes a tov lev. That person becomes mishteh tamid, perpetual party. That's a person who's not lazy. Because they know that each day is another opportunity, and each day they can make things happen. And each day God has trusted them to make things happen. So therefore, nothing to be overwhelmed about. Yes, the day might be challenging. The day might be not what we wanted it to be. But if I believe that every day has a purpose, and I believe that God gave me that day, and I believe God gave me life that day because He believes in me, then I get going. One step at a time, 1 hour at a time, 1 minute at a time. And each minute I try to find the purpose that I can in that particular moment. Therefore, that's the antidote to laziness. I've said this before, but I met great, great Hasidic Jews that came from the former Soviet Union who had every challenge you could think of, right? In addition, they were incredibly humble people. See, one of the ideas of you, there's another verse in Tehillim, I think, where associates joy with humility. You see, because before I get back to this Hasidim, because one important thing just to mention. First of all, it's not easy, by the way, right? And happiness is not necessarily an easy thing. People, when we confuse happiness with pleasure, then we think we take the easy way out. Because the pleasurable way is normally the easy way. We do what's not good for me now. We do what's enjoyable for me now, right? Happiness is about inner purpose. Inner purpose takes work. The Rambam says that joy is avodah gedolah. It's a very, very huge effort it takes. Right? It also takes huge humility. Why does it take huge humility? Interesting enough, we don't normally associate joy with humility. But it does, because true joy, which comes from inner purpose, means that I don't take myself that seriously. I don't do what I want to do now in terms of pleasure. What's pleasure for me now? I do what's better for the greater good, the greater purpose. In other words, joy really comes from letting God into my life, letting values into my life, right? And understanding that that's the way I'll be able to see purpose and find meaning, which will give me joy, right? That's why I saw people that there was a particular Jew I'm thinking of, I'm sure I've told the story with him before. His name was Reb Mendel Futterfass, great Hasid, a very famous Hasid. I met him a few times, he was really old when I met him. He was a Jew who was very dedicated to other people. In fact, he was in Russia when when people used to go underground there to learn Torah or do mitzvot or help other people. And he was one of those, and he did it, and he was very happy to do it. Eventually, he got caught. What did he get caught doing? It's an amazing thing, just to show you what a selfless person he was, right? But a man who was whole life was about purpose. There was a time in Russia, and if you know, there was a window of opportunity where people were able to leave. I think it was after Stalin. It was after Stalin died or something. It wasn't Stalin died, it was before that. There was a short period, I think, under Stalin, where they allowed people with Polish passports to leave Russia. Right? I know what it was. I think it was more like at the beginning of communism, at the beginning of communism, I think. Where they trapped everyone in Russia, but in former Soviet Union, but they allowed people with Polish passports to do. So Remendel Futervoz was part of an underground group of Hasidim that organized, forged Polish passports for many, many people to leave. Because staying in Russia was completely dangerous, especially if you had anything to do with Judaism. Right? So he helped people leave Russia. At the end, he had the opportunity, he got a lot of people out. At the end, he had the opportunity to do it himself, to forge a passport himself and to leave. And he said he's not doing it until the last person leaves, until anyone he knows that he can help. And the last moment, they caught him. So he had helped so many people. You can imagine how, you know, kind of chest that was, right? I'm trying to paint you the picture of the kind of person he was. He had helped so many people, and then he got caught, and he was sentenced to I don't know how many years in Siberia. Right? He never broke in Siberia. They tried to break him. He never broke. Eventually, he came out. His family managed to escape Russia. He had sent his family out, but he didn't. Eventually, he came out. Just after he came out, tragedy struck, and a daughter of his was killed in a car accident. Yeah. So you think a guy like that would be traumatized, down, broken. I've never seen a happier person. Never. Like, always. He's always had a smile on his face. Always. Always was good for a Faringan to inspire other people. And he also wasn't a lazy person at all. He was a driven person. He became a mentor in a yeshiva in Kfar Chabad in Israel. My older brother, of blessed memory, learned in that yeshiva. He's talked about him a lot. I never studied under him, but I met him a number of times in New York, right? I heard him talk a number of times. He was the epitome of happiness. Epitome of happiness. Why? Because for him, happiness came from within. Because he was totally purpose-driven. From inside out. Meaning-driven. That was his whole life. So when things are going well, very good. But if they're not, there's a purpose there too. I mean, it's a very high level. I'm not saying it's easy to reach that. But he was a regular guy, I'm saying. But he was, and that's why he was always happy. Any day that he could fill with purpose was always good. Even when he was in prison, he used to tell stories of how he was, how he used to make other people happy, or he used to daven as best as he could, serve God as best as he could. If that's where God put him, so he had to try his best. And he kept his eye on the purpose. So he told that famous story of when he was asked once how he survived. What was the story? Remember?
About the cows?
No, not the cows, someone else. But his answer was that that one time in prison, he saw a show. Some guy came and they made like one prisoner knew how to, he was a tightrope walker from before he was put there. And he did a show for the prisoners. They tied the string to two trees and he tightrope. So afterwards, the guy came down and he said, "How do you do that? How does tightrope walking work?" Because, you know, the Baal Shem Tov always says you got to learn a lesson from everything. So how did it work? So he said, the most important thing is you don't look right, you don't look left, and you definitely don't look back. You stay focused on the goal. So that's how I knew how to survive. So tightrope walk his way through the whole years of prison. Why? Right? Just focused on the goal. The goal was purpose, right? So that's the antidote to laziness. Because when you're purpose-driven, there is no laziness. Because you know that every day, every hour, there's an opportunity to accomplish something. Right? Similar, people don't look back, don't get caught in the past, are driven on looking forward and helping others. And achieving purpose. That's what it is, right? So I'll just share with you two concepts. One has to do with a weekly parasha of a couple of weeks ago. So we find in the Medrash that the epitome of this concept, the Zohar says this, was the matriarch Sarah, right? Sarah Imena. Why? Because the Zohar talks about, and it's explained by the commentaries, and it's an interesting concept, that there were three people who were connected, and it took Sarah to finally fix the idea and to set it straight. So the three people that were connected to the idea of joy was Eve, Chava, Noah, and Sarah. That's what the Zohar says. It's a Kabbalistic connection between those three people. Chava messed up with the concept of joy. Why? Because Chava also, but all three wanted to achieve joy. But only Sarah was able to do it properly. So Chava wanted to achieve joy, but she mixed up, she confused pleasure with joy. Pleasure with happiness. And that was essentially the Kabbalistic explanation of the sin of the first fruit. As we know that many opinions say the first fruit was a grape. So Chava wanted to achieve joy, she just thought, oh, grape is connected with joy. All right, wine. Wine brings happiness. What she confused was that she didn't understand that not the grape, it's the wine. And symbolically, they're very different. The grape is a sweet fruit, it tastes good, but it tastes good on the outside. Wine is about revealing the inside, right? That's the idea of nichna, it's the hidden power. And the Kabbalah tells us that had even Adam and Eve waited a few hours, they would have been allowed to eat from that fruit because they would have made kiddush on it. They would have taken the grapes and squeezed it and made kiddush on the Friday night. Which is one of the reasons we make kiddush on Friday night, because we're on wine. Because we're still fixing that original sin of the first fruit, right? The idea was that she understood, because the pasuk says, the verse says, she looked at the fruit and she saw that it looked delicious. That's fine. And having a delicious fruit is really good. But not if your goal is joy. If you're trying to achieve happiness, you're not going to achieve it through a nice grape. You're going to achieve it through using the grape for something purposeful, maybe. Which is the idea of the kiddush Friday night, to make a blessing, to achieve some purpose, yes. So that was Chava. So came along Noach, right? And Noach, after the flood, planted a vineyard, the Torah tells us. And he got drunk, but drunk in a negative way. Right? He made wine and he got drunk. And he didn't know what was happening around him, and then his son came and mutilated him. It was like a whole story, a very bad story. And he got rescued by his other two sons, Shem and Yafes, right? What was his mistake? His mistake is you can't achieve joy through escaping. Escaping. To achieve joy, you have to be soul-driven, but you have to be very present. Because it's about accomplishment, it's about purpose. So Noach didn't achieve joy. Just to get... Yeah, some drunk people are very happy, but they're not present. Right? Comes along Sarah, and the Torah tells us an amazing thing. The Torah says like this. When the Torah talks about the years of Sarah, it says that when the Torah is describing the passing away of Sarah, right? It says the life of Sarah was 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years, right? And then 127 years, in other words. And then it repeats, and these are the years of Sarah. So it's a very complicated pasuk because it's very said very funny. Why do you have to say 100 years, 20 years, 7 years, 127, right? Okay, so it says that when she was 100, she was like 20 in regard to a spiritual, she was like still pure. When she was 20, she was beautiful, she was 7, and so on and so forth. But then the pasuk goes on and repeats, it says, and these are the years of Sarah. What do we need an extra phrase for? So Rashi brings down that when the Torah repeats, these are the years of Sarah, it says one phrase, an amazing phrase. The phrase it says is, Kulan shavin letova. That all these are the years of Sarah, they were all equally good. Now what does it mean they were all equally good? If you ever look at the life of Sarah, they were not all equally good. Some of them were good years, some of them were really challenging years. For many years she was childless, distressing years. Then she went down to Egypt and she got captured and kidnapped by Pharaoh's palace. Not a very good day. Right? She went through tough times. And then the commentaries say, why does the Torah add the words, these are the years of Sarah, because kulan shavin l'tavah, they're all equally good. And the commentaries explain, that's exactly what it is. They were all equally good. Because Sarah achieved the ultimate of happiness, where she understood that the days are different, but I am the same. And my purpose is the same. That every day I wake up in the morning and I think, yeah, I'm going to plan the day as best as I can, but I don't know how it's going to turn out, but however it turns out, that my values haven't changed. My purpose hasn't changed. And I can make this day, I can live this day to achieve my values no matter how the day turns out. Of course, we pray only for good and we ask God to bless us for good, not to challenge us, not to test us, because who knows if we'll pass the test. But the concept of joy is that we are focus-driven. We come from the inside out. We live by our soul. Purpose-driven, meaning-driven. And therefore, kulan shavin otva, they were indeed all good. Because every day she made it work. Every day she achieved a purpose. Every day she lived by her values. Every day she achieved another connection to God. And a similar thing, I'll just end with this. We find out, I mentioned it on Tuesday, for those who were there Tuesday, but the Parsha Shari, but I saw an amazing thing. That Yaakov, right, so he's on the way to his uncle Laban, and then he goes there and he ends up there for 20 years. Now his father-in-law was not a good man, if you know the story. A con man, a difficult guy. Right? And he had a tough time there. Those 20 years were very tough. He was in Haran. Yaakov was in Haran. It was a very immoral environment. His father-in-law was impossible. He tried to work for him. He changed his wages every 5 minutes. It was a tough time. Right? And the Medrash says, how did he survive? How did he survive that? What did he do to survive? So there's a very cryptic Medrash. The Medrash says that every night he would recite 15 chapters of Psalms. Now, Psalms hadn't been written yet, but it means the symbolic 15 chapters of Psalms. There are 15 chapters of Psalms that start with the word Shir HaMa'alot, a song of ascension, right? We use the word song in the beginning. Shir HaMa'alot. There's 15 verses that all start with the same words, Shir HaMa'alot. 15 chapters, right? And that's what he recites. So what's the idea behind that? So there's two things. I'll just finish with this. So, what's the significance of number 15? So we find just a historic, fascinating concept that our forefathers, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, overlapped for 15 years. So when Yaakov was 15, that's when Abraham died. So they lived together for 15 years. And we know that Kabbalistically, the three patriarchs represent Chesed, Gevura, and Tiferet. These are different parts of our personality, right? Now, this is also a similar thing. When we're into ourselves, then we locked into our own personality, be it Chesed, be it Gevura, as we've spoken about many times. When we're purpose-driven, then we know whatever it takes to do, we're going to do. If we need Chesed one day, we'll use Chesed. If we need Gevura the other day, we'll use Gevura. Whatever it takes to achieve our purpose. So he brought together the 15 years. That's what Yaakov did. But how did he bring them together? By reciting these chapters. Shir HaMa'alot, which starts with the word Shir, song, happiness. So Yaakov reminded himself what true happiness is all about. He wasn't living in a very happy environment. But he understood that happiness comes from him. Comes from within. And by being happy that way, by being purpose-driven and meaning-driven the entire time, he was survived those 15 years at Laban. So that's the true understanding of joy, the way King Solomon puts it. Tov lev, if you have a good heart, if you're working from your heart, if you're working from your soul, then the whole life is a celebration. The whole life is a party. That's the ultimate antidote to laziness, because when there's purpose, there is no laziness. Because when there's purpose, which means we let in God and we believe in God and we believe that He's given us every single day as an opportunity, then we're purpose-driven and we get on with the job and we hopefully accomplish and we feel that inner sense of fulfillment and ultimate happiness. Have a good day.